We were at the 25th anniversary of the Holocaust in Rwanda, 25 years ago, April the 6th, the Holocaust in Rwanda erupted. This is particularly relevant at this time because we've got characters in this country talking about doing something like that in South Africa. People wanting to have a genocide of all whites and coloureds in South Africa. We've got lunatics like the BFLF, Black First, Land First, and the EFF, and the Land Party, and the ANC, all talking genocidal talk and singing things like One Settler, One Bullet, and singing about kill the Boer, kill the farmer. Well, 25 years ago, something like that happened up in Rwanda. And this is a country smack in the heart of Africa. It was at one time part of German East Africa, part of Tanganyika, but after the Versailles Treaty 1919 was given to Belgium. And so the Belgians ruled from 1919 to 1960, and Rwanda and Burundi were both German East Africa, which became Belgium as a result of the Versailles Treaty, which explains their unique background. And they're between the Congo, Uganda, Tanzania, and of course Burundi, so four countries surrounded. This was the site of the most extraordinary violence. And yet, interestingly enough, when we had our Livingston 200 just a few years ago in 2013, covering 12 countries, our team reckoned that Rwanda was the cleanest, neatest, best-run, most litter-free, and not only that, but also a country where they felt the safest. Now, how did that change so dramatically after they were one of the worst hellholes on the planet? This is a mostly mountainous country, very, very mountainous, and they are part of the network of Great Lakes. Lake Kivu is part of it, which feeds into the White Nile, which is one of the greatest rivers of Earth. And they also have very high mountains, including the Mountains of the Moon, which are shared with Uganda and the Congo, where the gorillas, as in the hairy gorillas, not the ones with the AK-47s, these are the nicer gorillas, live up there. This was the site of the disaster, the genocide, the Holocaust in 1994, Kigali being the capital smack in the middle. All of these places, I've been as far down as to Butare and as high up as Kagitumba and over to Rugengeri. It's quite a beautiful country, actually, quite a stunning country. Now, the situation at the beginning of the genocide was there were over 500,000 Rwandese refugees outside, mostly actually in Uganda, which is why the Tutsi minority, who had fled previous massacres, were concentrated in very high numbers in Uganda and Tanzania, and they had adopted English. This is significant because of the Belgians having taken over from 1919, French was the official language, but because of previous massacres from 1962 on, always targeting the Tutsi minority, a vast amount of Tutsis were outside the country where they had acquired English from Ugandan and Tanzanian schools and where they had also acquired some training in the Ugandan army, which explains why today English is the official language in Rwanda, not Tutsi. This is all part of the background. And of course, there were also Burundian refugees in southern Rwanda, mainly Hutu, had fled from massacres in Burundi. So you've got a bit of an interesting situation there. And this is part of the massive national park, which is where you get so many of the gorillas up in the north. This UN Security Council made the comment, the crocodiles in Kagera River and the vultures of Rwanda have seldom had it so good. And that's thanks to the United Nations, actually. The ease with which the orchestrators of the genocide in Rwanda confused the international journalists and abused the national media for mobilizing unprecedented concentration of carnage raised all kinds of uncomfortable questions about the role of the media and of the church and of the United Nations. In its 1,200-page report, which I scoured and studied on the genocide in Rwanda, African Rights concluded, the response to the aftermath of the genocide has been almost as shocking as the response to the genocide itself. Progress towards justice has been negligible. Now, they're talking about internationally. Rwanda itself actually made some serious strides. But there was only about 70 prosecutions by the International Court of Justice on this. Now, tens of thousands of prosecutions have been done inside Rwanda, but outside, where a lot of the genocidal lunatics and architects are, living in France and Canada under protection of governments that signed the anti-genocide treaty, but continue to protect the genocidal architects in places like Justin Trudeau's Canada and France itself, progress towards justice has been negligible. On the contrary, there's been a concentrated attempt to distort or deny what has happened, which is why this kind of presentation 25 years later is important. The survivors of the genocide are not the beneficiaries of national and international compassion and support. Rather, they're almost wholly forgotten. While displaced people and refugees receive massive and indiscriminate assistance. Now, what are they talking about? The refugees were the genocidal maniacs, the Interahamwe, the Hutu mass murderers, who fled under French protection under Operation Turquoise, where the French came in and provided a shield behind which they could retreat to Zaire, what today is called the Congo, where they received protection from Mobutu Sese Seko's government. And some of them then, of course, flew to France and Canada and so on, other French-speaking countries where they could be protected. So the refugees, which were either the Interahamwe or their relatives or people in sympathy with them, who fled to neighboring Tanzania or Congo, they received the world's hundreds of billions of dollars of aid. But the people who were the victims of the genocide, virtually nothing. Still quoting from the African Rights 1,200-page document, the refusal to face the reality of what is one of the very worst crimes against humanity since the foundation of the United Nations. Well said. The African Rights Report found the killings were meticulously organized in advance. Genocides, by the definition, are planned and organized, orchestrated, not spontaneous. The French-trained presidential guard, the army, the gendarmes, the civil administrators were all willing instruments in the genocide. Here's the fact. Most of the people killed, the thousands of people killed in hospitals, were killed by doctors and nurses. Hutu doctors and nurses killed Tutsi patients. Most of the children in the schools and teachers in the schools were killed by teachers and students in the schools. Hutu teachers and students killed Tutsi students and teachers. Most of those killed in the churches were also killed by so-called churches, church members and church leaders. Hutu priests, nuns, bishops, even the Archbishop of the Catholic Church was one of the orchestrators of the genocide, and he lives, I think, under the protection of the French-speaking Canadian government right now. So you had heads of denominations orchestrating the killing of their own members just because they're the wrong tribe. You had doctors, gynecologists killing pregnant women in the hospitals with machetes. This is documented. This is what happened. They literally coordinated. The government could have done it themselves. The soldiers could have gone and shot the people, but they chose to mobilize the people and get the people themselves, teachers, students, doctors, nurses, priests, to kill their neighbors who are of the wrong tribe while they stood by with the AKs and had watched the people kill them with machetes. Why? To make the entire country guilty and to make the entire country accomplices in their own crime. The killings in Rwanda were no spontaneous outburst. We heard that word endlessly for the first 6 weeks, spontaneous outburst. But they followed instructions to the highest level. And this was so orchestrated, so well known, so well documented. It was warned about for months ahead by General Romeo Dallaire, the head of the UN Security Council, Operation UNIMIR, United Nations Military Assistance Mission to Rwanda. He was warning Warren Christopher, who was the American Secretary of State, and Madeleine Not-So-Bright, American Ambassador to the UN, and of course Boutros Ghali, the Egyptian head of the UN at time, General Secretary, and of course head of the Security Council as immediate supervisor, Kofi Annan from Ghana. They were being informed 4 months before the genocide began of the plans of the intention of killing 11,000 people per hour. They didn't manage that. They only managed 11,000 people per day. They weren't quite as efficient as they'd hoped, but their plan had been to kill 11,000 people an hour. African Rights condemned the gullibility of the international media for accepting the MRND, that's the movement Revolutionary National Democratic, that's basically in French, the MRND. They were the one-party dictatorship of Rwanda. Their party line was the killings were tribal anarchy and uncontrollable tribal killing. That was the term we kept hearing for the first 6 months. By portraying the genocide as tribalism and as a result of the war, they kept talking about the war, but there wasn't a war. When the genocide began, there was absolutely no war, and this was just smokescreen. A smokescreen of confusion to provide the killers with the cover they needed to proceed with their diabolical plans. Central to the Hutu MRND government strategy was to sow confusion so that nobody knew actually what was happening. They isolated their victims by imposing a news blackout, cutting the telephone links, establishing a dense network of roadblocks, imposing a nationwide curfew. If you watch the film Shooting Dogs, otherwise known as Beyond the Gates, it starts with this British journalist working in the area, helping actually a Catholic mission, and he's on the phone talking, and suddenly, hello, hello, click, click, hello, 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 and he's in this telephone booth, and that's the first indication something's gone wrong. The telephone lines all were cut at the right time. Just an incredibly well-organized, well-orchestrated nationwide genocidal campaign. These measures kept the people in their homes and prevented most people from fleeing. And General Romeo Dallaire had really documented that they had been taking a year earlier. They'd started to make a list of every single Tutsi or half-Tutsi or Tutsi or Hutu married to a Tutsi all over the country. And they had their addresses and they'd been working it out in blocks and block committees as to these are the people you've got to kill. And so the whole idea was to keep people in homes so you could easily find them. Anyone who tries to flee, we'll get them at the roadblocks. When the genocide was launched, 6th of April 1994, most African correspondents were in South Africa for the Mandela elections. And the genocide was directly timed to coincide with the Mandela elections, knowing the entire world was watching the charade carrying on here, South Africa's first free and fair elections, where most of the votes were never actually counted because they were so confused and disorganized. And where, in the end, as the IEC chairman even admitted, we extrapolated and did horse trading. They never counted most of the votes cast in 1994, which was a complete charade. Free, fair, farce, failure, fraud. It was, but nevertheless, it provided a wonderful smokescreen and distraction, because while most people were watching the charade in South Africa, they could happily kill a few hundred thousand Tutsi in Rwanda, and nobody would actually care or notice. There were actually only two international journalists in Rwanda at the time. One's depicted in Shake Hands with the Devil, where there's this one female correspondent who tags on to the general from Canada who gave her some protection that she could cover some of it, and the other one was depicted in Hotel Rwanda, who was basically in the hotel and covering there. They were in Kigali, in the capital city, cut off from what was going on in the rural areas. Following the assassinations of the president, who was, of course, party to the plans for the genocide, but they considered him he was a little bit on the side of negotiation, a little bit on the side of compromise, so they decided to sacrifice their own president, and they shot him down. In fact, it's the first and only time, I think, in history where two presidents have been assassinated simultaneously. The president of Burundi and Rwanda were both in the same plane, arriving in Kigali. They'd just come from Tanzania, where they'd been having some peace negotiations, signed a peace agreement, this, that, and the other, allowing for integration of Tutsi people into the government and so on. And so as his plane came into land with the Burundi and Rwandan president on board, his own presidential guard from the presidential palace itself fired the surface-to-air missile, French-provided surface-to-air missile, proven by the UN investigators from Belgium immediately afterwards. They took down their own president's plane and conveniently blamed this on the rebels, who were nowhere near the place and didn't have access to French heat-seeking missiles anyway. And but never mind, it doesn't matter who killed him. We blame it on the rebels, and that's the excuse, that's the trigger to launch the so-called spontaneous outbreak of tribal violence. They sought to confuse the mass killings of defenseless people with the war. There wasn't a war, but anyway, for the first week, in fact, the Rwandese Patriotic Front, who were up in the very north on the border of Uganda, were warning the Canadian general, if you don't do something to stop this, if the international community doesn't step in, we are going to launch an offensive to try and save our own people. And the Shake Hands with the Devil book confirms this, that he was going back and forwards negotiating, and Paul Kagame, head of the Rwandese Patriotic Front, kept saying, if you don't stop this, we will have to do what we can. Not that they thought they had any chance of success, but when the international community did absolutely flat nothing to save any lives, of course the RPF launched the war. And it's only their war that stopped the genocide. So the genocide wasn't the war, the genocide wasn't the cause of the war. In fact, only the war ended the genocide. But why ruin a good story with facts? Thirdly, the MRND played the humanitarian card by pleading for emergency aid. And all of this deflected attention from the central issue of the genocide. All distraction, distraction, distraction. The tendency of most journalists to label every conflict in Africa as tribalism has become absolutely absurd. Many foreign aid workers fueled this tendency with ill-informed comments such as, everyone is killing everyone. That's as helpful as people blaming the victim for crimes. For example, farmers who get murdered, it's their fault they didn't have enough no trespassing signs. Dead serious. That's the kind of mindless garbage you get from some idiots. Or a woman who's attacked at night, why was she out alone in that part of town? So it's not the criminal's fault anymore, it's now the victim's fault. Blame the victim. Everyone is killing everyone. It's uncontrollable violence. The Hutus and Tutsis are killing one another again. Yeah, but one side's armed and the other side isn't. That's not a war, that's murder. Having killed the opposition politicians, right up to the vice president and the president, Rwandese journalists, human rights activists and others, anyone who might present an accurate report on the bloodshed, they were the first ones they targeted. The journalists, the human rights activists, they were the first in line. The MRND government then pursued their second strategy of disinformation to confuse the issue with self-serving false reports. They portrayed the violence as spontaneous rage of the population in response to the assassination of their president, meaning the unelected mass-murdering dictator, even though it was the MRND government and military who were responsible for the assassination of the president themselves. In Shake Hands with the Devil, Romeo Delio reports how when he saw the plans and he had an informant who was high up in the MRND government come to him with the plans, the details, the clockwork, hour-by-hour plans of how they were going to assassinate and murder up to 11,000 people an hour with their systematic genocide. He took this to the head of the Security Council, which is Kofi Annan, who took it to the General Secretary, Butrus Ghali, informed Warren Christopher and Madeleine Albright, or not so bright, who informed Bill Clinton. They were all informed of this 4 months before the genocide, January 1994, and he was ordered to take this whole plan to the president. He said, but it's the president's people who are planning it, the president's aware of this, according to the informant. Nevertheless, had to take the whole file to him, which of course endangered the informant, and he was then informed he wasn't allowed to provide protection to this informant, who of course got murdered. That doesn't help other people willing to give the UN military UNAMIR assistance plan any further information when you won't even protect your own sources. So the president even knew of the plan. He just didn't realize that he was also a sacrificial lamb as part of it. He had approved the plan. This is Habi Anuramana. He is one of the... He literally signed the documents which included murdering him, basically. But it shows you shouldn't sign things you haven't read all the details of. In the first days, international attention generally focused on the plight of the foreigners. Camera crews were very understandably only prepared to travel with international troops, whose mission was to evacuate the foreigners. And this naturally led to a slanted, incomplete picture being portrayed to the world. I took this picture at UNIMIR's HQ. This is the stadium in which evangelistic crusades by Reinhard Bonnke were held. Tens of thousands converted just a few years before this genocide in the same stadium. Revival sweeps Rwanda, he said. This is another reason why it's so relevant. Just believe, just pray this prayer. It's easy to be a Christian. Just raise your hand while every eye is closed. This kind of just come to the front. Cheap grace and easy believism isn't helping. Because if genuine gospel had been preached and if genuine revival had hit and if these people had been really discipled in the word of God, then there wouldn't have been accessories to murder, mass murder. this just shows that superficial, cheap, easy believism and sensational, spectacular type of crusades doesn't guarantee a thing. It's enough to distract people, make them think they're getting real Christianity, but it's actually inoculating them. In this stadium, 15,000 Tutsi came for protection, protected by Pakistani UN troops, who, when Kofi Annan ordered them to withdraw, withdrew, leaving all that were left there to be massacred. But before that, through these gates, every single day, the Interahamwe came with a list of journalists, teachers, human rights activists. And the UN went to the trouble of going through, calling names, finding those people, round them up, bring them to the gates, and they were hacked to death within sight of the Pakistani UN guards at the gates. And the next day, the Interahamwe came with another list. And they went to the trouble of finding those people, bring them out, and they were also killed. And this happened for weeks, day after day, until the UN just evacuated and then the rest could get killed too. That's Kofi Annan for you. The strategy of disinformation and terror, so callously and effectively orchestrated by the MRND Hutu government Rwanda, was spectacularly successful. With most international attention focused on South Africa's volatile Mandela elections, enthronement, beatification, whatever they wanted to call it, there were no journalists in the rural areas of Rwanda reporting on the massacres there. Who cared? I mean, the real news is happening in Pretoria, isn't it? The rural genocide was effectively hidden from the outside world for almost 3 weeks. People didn't even know there was anything going on anywhere outside of Rwanda, outside of Kigali, Rwanda's capital. Aaron Makuba, whose whole family was wiped out, complained, "The world persists in characterizing the bloodshed as ethnic clashes. We who've lost our families, relatives, colleagues, and neighbors regard this as unfair, unjust, and a source of immense pain." That's putting it mildly, I'm sure. "People should stop describing Rwanda to us as tribes in the process of killing one another," said Médecins Sans Frontières Dr. Jean-Herve Bradol. "I think it really is the final insult to the victims to present matters in this way." It really insults the victims when you portray them as equally guilty with the people who've been murdering them. "And I believe that this way of presenting things is not altogether incidental, perhaps in order to justify the passivity of various parties." Just take, for example, anyone who reports in Europe or Australia or America of the systematic murder of farmers in South Africa. Oh, well, they deserve it, you know, because of apartheid or because of Jan van Riebeck or something. And so you get this endless attitude of, well, so what? And it's not important. And anyway, they're all racist, so they deserve it. And there's this rationalization of genocide and blaming of victims. Why? It justifies the passivity and inactivity and heartless sitting on the fence mentality of those hearing the news. How to rationalize callous indifference. So this is the basic countdown. 6th of April, Hutu President Juvenal Habyarimana killed when his plane was shot down, along with the president of neighboring Burundi, mind you. And then encouraged by the authorities, Hutu extremists start killing the Tutsis, moderate Hutus, in Kigali. What's a moderate Hutu? Well, he doesn't want to kill his Tutsi neighbor. And violence spreads across the country.
Would that have included Hutus married to Tutsis as well?
Yes. Oh, totally. Totally. Yes. Oh, they were regarded just the same. And one of the Ten Commandments that they had there was no Bahutu is to marry a Batutsi, and so on. They actually had a Ten Commandments literally sent out, which we've got quoted in the book. So the Rwandese Patriotic Front, of course, started to march on Kigali, of course, from the north, from Mulundi, which was their kind of northern base or HQ. All the Westerners were evacuated in the second week from the 9th to the 16th. At the height of the massacres, the UN withdrew all but 270 of their 2,500 peacekeepers. In fact, they ordered them all out, and only the refusal of General Romeo Dallaire to evacuate his HQ that he had a small group of 270. The Belgians, who were his best, most reliable troops, they evacuated within the first few days because they just had 10 of their Belgian troops massacred. But those Belgian troops were ordered directly from Kofi Annan. You're not allowed to fire unless fired upon. And so, of course, they were overwhelmed, disarmed, actually laid down the weapons on the request of the Interahamwe mass murderers. In the middle of a genocide, what's the most intelligent thing to do? Lay down your weapons when the murderers ask you to. They were not killed quickly. They were killed slowly. They cut them up, starting with the feet with machetes. And straight off that, Belgium ordered all their people withdrawn. Now, the Belgians were General Romeo Dallier's best people. They spoke French, and they were competent troops, and so he lost his best. And so when the Pakistanis and everyone else evacuated, he only had 270 people to care for, just a few of the people that were in their care, but most of them, like the Pakistanis who'd been protecting the stadium, they left. And so there were tens of thousands of people murdered who had been, they thought, under the sanctuary and protection of the UN. So that's Kofi Annan for you. The Security Council conceded by May the 17th. That is, what, 6 weeks later? Acts of genocide may have been committed. In fact, if you've listened to the Hotel Rwanda film, which is generally not a good film, it's all filmed in South Africa with South African and Americans playing Rwandese, which is why it just falls flat. It doesn't look like Rwanda. It isn't Rwanda. And there are not even Rwandese in it, unlike the Shake Hands with the Devil or Shooting Dogs films, which were totally filmed in Rwanda with the Rwandese taking a key part. But at the beginning, you actually hear the imbecile for the White House speaking for Bill Clinton saying, "We concede that acts of genocide have been committed in Rwanda, but we deny that what has taken place is genocide." So acts of genocide have been committed, but we deny that it is genocide. And then the question comes back, well, how many acts of genocide need to be committed for it to be genocide? And, oh, well, that's a very complicated question. So that's just one of the things you hear in the background if you're paying attention to the radio, but I remember that, actually, at the time. So June the 23rd, France launched Operation Turquoise. You see this, these purple lines here. Operation Turquoise was a safe zone where French paratroopers came in to secure the southwestern portion of the country and to use it as a channel, a safe zone behind which the genocide leaders could escape to Zaire, what today is the Congo. By July the 4th, American Independence Day, the RPF captured Kigali, the government collapsed, the massacre stopped, and then 2 million Hutus flee Rwanda under French protection. And they're the ones who get the massive amounts of foreign aid, the ones who were accessories to the genocide. And for some strange reason, France was criticized for its role. So you can see the general statistic, 84% Hutu, 15% Tutsi. I would venture to guess it's now closer to 10% Tutsi. And the book Holocaust Rwanda, I subtitled The Roles of Gun Control, Media Manipulation, Liberal Church Leaders in the United Nations. In fact, this one person in America particularly paid for a 5,000 print run just to distribute to every congressman in America and things like that. Then we did a French translation, which we launched in France. I took it to France personally and ensured that this was received all over France, even the capital in Paris, and didn't get much applause for that in France, though. This is the Baptist Theological Seminary in Kigali, and these are orphans. 400,000 orphans as a result of the genocide. Mostly Tutsi children, of course. 90% of the 1.17 million murdered in Rwanda were 90% were Tutsi. One of the hospitals that we went to, they had thousands of bodies to pull out of the hospitals. I was staying with a Samaritan's Purse team, and just to give you a bit of a feel of it, there's a plague of rats, rats bigger than our cats running around, rats, massive rats. And they were all over the place, and there was this poor American woman who was absolutely paranoid about rats. So she chose the top bunk in this house that we were in. And there were mouse traps all over the place. Well, I think some of those rats would have laughed at the little mouse traps. But it hadn't crossed my mind or anyone else's, actually, that the top bunk's probably the worst place to be if you don't like rats, because they come through the ceiling. And, of course, the ceilings are not all intact anyway. And so the rats are up in the rafters and they come down. So remember in the middle of the night, this blood-curdling scream. I went hurtling out there, you know, expecting that she's being attacked by Hutus with machetes, and turned out that a rat had jumped down on her head from the roof on a top bunk. And this poor woman had screamed herself off the top bunk and fallen down. It was absolute chaos and pandemonium in there. But just one example. Well, during the day, everyone would have to put on these these massive orange overalls where you sort of put them in from bottom and then got wading boots, because the main job was to wade into the sewage system of the hospital to pull out all the bodies and to chip away at the congealed blood to enable the water to flow and the drainage system to operate, because we couldn't operate the hospital. You don't even want to see pictures of the maternity ward, the blood up the walls. They were walking around maternity wards hacking people to death. And remember that this was being done by gynecologists, nurses, doctors. It's just beyond comprehension what was going on there. This is just one of the classic pictures. The United Nations' complicity in disarming the general population of Rwanda enabled the genocide of April, May 1994. Notice this stupid monument, whatever they call it, outside the UN building. By the way, we've got a miniature of this in the waterfront in Cape Town. Exact miniature of this. You would have seen this at the waterfront. Now, what is this? This is the UN's monument against, or for disarmament against weapons. But notice, it's not an AK-47. It's not an RPG. It's not an SKS. Or any of the other standard weapons used by communist terrorists and mass murderers. It's a revolver, which is a police or private weapon. It's the weapon of choice of the average woman who wants a weapon, a nice revolver which can't jam and which doesn't need cocking, loading, and no safety catches. It's a good civilian defensive weapon. It doesn't have a high magazine capacity. It's not easy to reload quickly in a firefight. This is just a civilian defensive weapon. That's what they choose, and I don't know that there's ever been a revolver with that long a barrel. But anyway, it's a stupid, dumb, idiotic, brainless piece of art and of no relation to reality anyway. But this just epitomizes what the UN's for. Let's disarm the potential victims. But forget about the guys running around with the AK-47s. The United Nations forces, under the direct control of Kofi Annan, this Ghanaian, failed to save lives. He expressly forbade his commander, General Romeo Dallier, to seize the million Red Chinese provided machetes in the warehouses beforehand. He was going to hit the stockpiles, let them know that the peacekeeping force is not going to tolerate this. And next thing he gets, you're forbidden. He says he wasn't asking for permission. In fact, why would he need permission? He's in charge of a peacekeeping operation. He's got information from the inside about these genocides being planned. He knows where the stockpiled weapons are, and he's going to seize them. I mean, how much closer to your mission mandate is that? I mean, how can that be wrong? Why would he need permission? Expressly forbidden to him. As he explains in his book, the military ethos is to obey orders. And his direct superior was, well, on the ground, was Cameroonian ex-foreign minister Boubou. I mean, that's his actual name, Boubou, who was totally in bed with the mass murderers. His primary superior was head of Security Council Kofi Annan, who received all kinds of accolades when he died recently at age 80, including from Sherrilyn Dudley, who described him in the most glowing terms. And I don't know what a Christian is doing praising such low-life scum as this Kofi Annan. The United Nations actually handed over thousands of Christian refugees who had fled to them for protection into the hands of the Interahamwe mass murderers to slaughter them. These bases, which are meant to be UN sanctuaries for the people to flee to find some protection. They weren't going out to protect people, but they could have at least protect the people who were in their bases, you would have thought. Kofi Annan went further than this. He didn't provide the food, medicines requested, or even the armored cars, or even ammunition requested by the team. So that, as General Romeo Dallier documents, his greatest regret in his life is that he didn't disobey orders and spend the rest of his life in prison. But at least he'd have a clear conscience. In Rwanda, United Nations forces were quick to abandon their peacekeeping missions. This, by the way, is a good example of how positioning your camera can produce a really good picture. Uninvolved in peace. Yeah, UN. Unaccountable, unfriendly, unreasonable, unregenerate, ungodly. They're just un. That's the UN. Yeah. Can you believe it? I believe in Santa Claus, one of the jerseys that were distributed in some food parcel. The churches, the hospitals, and the schools were the primary areas of mass murder. So the whole goal was to terrify the people to staying home, and if they flee, we get them to roadblocks. But if they flee to the sanctuaries, where are they going to flee to? Hospitals, schools, churches. Then we'll surround the hospitals, schools, and churches and wipe them out. Now, I'm mentioning this because I know that in this country, we've got a person called Simon Roach. Simon Roach has done speaking tours all over the world. He's on YouTube all the time. He's representing Söderlunders. And he's the one who is one of the most panic-mongering agent provocateurs possible. His official CV is ex-ANC member, who now is the main spokesman for Söderlunders. Now, Söderlunders are, I'm sure, a good group, but obviously they must be infiltrated, and I'm convinced that this Simon Roach is an infiltrator. He's an agent provocateur for the enemy. Because Simon Roach's main, and you can see the Canadian woman who did this excellent Farmlands documentary, she gives a lot of time, maybe 15 minutes, to Simon Roach. And Simon Roach's primary strategy is to panic everyone. At the moment any violence comes, and the moment that Söderlunders gives the word, all these farmers who belong to Söderlunders are to pack up, leave their homes, and move to some central place. Which, of course, abandons your farms, which can then be looted, which, of course, thank you, that's exactly what BLF and EFF want. And then they're all more vulnerable. Because they're in a centralized place. They're not in their farm, defending their home turf. They're in some central, or they can be ambushed on the road. And it's the most insane thing, and I've challenged, as of others, that Simon Roach, you're actually playing in the hands of the enemy. I think he's deliberate. I don't think he's ex-ANC. I think he's an ANC plant in Söderlunders who's setting the people up for to fail. Because you know that this happens. At the end of the First World War and the Bolshevik Revolution, the Bolsheviks started up anti-communist movements. In fact, they control them all. Every pro-monarchist, anti-Bolshevik, anti-communist, anti-Soviet institution, agency and organization, the whole of Western Europe, was organized and controlled by the Cheka, which later became the NKVD and the KGB. They set up their own opposition because they knew people would want to oppose, so they set up their own opposition to which they could flee so that they could then control them. Just like General Tinny Groenewald, who used to be head of military intelligence, informed me personally that the South African government, the National Party, set up the AWB as their own opposition because Eugene Tablanche was one of their sergeants in the security police, security branch, and they instructed him to set up the AWB, make it look neo-Nazi, to attract all the opposition to National Party government activities so that they could know and control. And that's why the AWB was never able to achieve anything, because the moment they tried to, they're already wrapped up, caught up, arrested, and so on, because their leader, who would have guessed, such a brilliant, well-spoken, charismatic speaker, was actually working for the other side. And this is the kind of nonsense that goes on. So Simon Roach of Söderlunders is poison. I think he's giving the worst advice possible. This is exactly what genocidal maniacs want. Flee to sanctuaries, indefensible sanctuaries, like hospitals, schools, and churches, so that we can pick you all off there. And that's why most of the massacres took place in hospitals, schools, and churches. As one survivor said, the people sang hymns and cried and prayed. Now, I mention it because how many of you have seen Hotel Rwanda? Okay, in Hotel Rwanda, what's missing? No prayer, no hymn singing at all, no Bible reading, no church services. In fact, you wouldn't even know there's a Christian amongst them, except that they've got some Catholic nuns and plainly dressed as nuns who arrive. Not that they say or do anything. But so you're meant to believe there's 1,200 Tutsi in the middle of a genocide with sounds of genocide all around them, and they don't have a prayer meeting, a church service. There's no hymn singing. There's no sign of Christian faith whatsoever, aside from some cross around a few nuns' face necks. But this is just ahistoric, which is why shooting dogs is more honest beyond the gates, because it shows the people gathering for worship, praying, the missionary involved, and so on. That's what happened. And of course, Roman Catholicism is the major religion in Rwanda. But there's a lot of syncretism. A lot of the Roman Catholics were also into witchcraft. The Tutsis, though, were overwhelmingly Protestant. And so most of the people killed were actually Protestant Tutsi minority. I took this picture in a church in Kigali, and I think you can get a bit of a feel with the shrapnel in the roof, the kind of things that was going on around here. And this picture, these pictures I took of Natarama Church, this was one of the most blood-curdling, disgusting experiences in my life. I took this picture in there, walking amongst how many corpses, who knows. There were something like 1,200 people killed in and around this church. I don't know if you can see the hole made there. They broke holes in the side and they threw hand grenades in. They walked in and hacked people to death, the survivors. And this was decided to be left as it was. And you can see the damage caused by clubs on some of the heads. Now this is a weird picture. You can't understand what this is unless you understand that this bus was transporting ammunition crates. And can you see the hole down the middle? The Rwandese Patriotic Front sent an RPG straight up the nose of this, and of course it hit the ammo crates, and this was modern work of art. You can just see the litter of bullet, thousands and thousands of expended shells that had just cooked off in the fire. And so this has nothing to do with the genocide. This is part of the war that stopped the genocide. Again, these are other pictures I took of. You can see the damage, destruction. This, by the way, was the security, I think they called it intelligence, headquarters where they did a lot of the interrogations and murders. And so when the RPF came in, they particularly demolished it by firing in, I think, 106s and so on. This is the actual parliament. These are the gates of parliament. And you can see from the bullet holes on the side that governments are not changed in Rwanda by ballots, but by bullets. If you watch the shooting, the Shake Hands with Devil film, you'll see there's a scene where they actually go through these very gates, actually done here, as you can see the troops going in through those gates, and it's quite extraordinary. They must have had full cooperation for the governor of Rwanda to make the Shake Hands with Devil, because they've got the actual sites, the actual places where all these things took place, and very, very unnerving to watch that. As you can see, child soldiers are no problem. All over Africa, you've got 12, 13, 14-year-old soldiers. And in Rwanda, it was no difference. This is one of the RPF. This is one of the rebels who fought to end the genocide. I mean, these people have probably lost their families and traumatized. These are also some of the RPF. You can see from the flag, that's the new flag. That's the flag of today. This is what the RPF... These would have been Ugandan armed, trained, and supplied Rwandese refugees in Uganda who came through. So these would have been the English-speaking rebels that the French government are holding line against. When the French Minister of Foreign Affairs was asked how they could justify being accessories to genocide before, during, and after, and even keeping many of the architects of this in France, the answer the French Foreign Minister publicly was, "We were holding the line for Francophone Africa against Anglophone Africa." In other words, the Hutu mass murderers, they speak French. The Tutsi, many of them speak English. So it's obvious who you've got to support. You support the people who speak your language, because the people who don't speak your language, they don't deserve to live, do they? I mean, this is just, how do you determine your foreign policy? We're holding the line for Francophone Africa against Anglophone Africa. So before this genocide, France had 22 countries in Africa that spoke French. Now they only have 21. Because Rwanda has officially moved to being an English-speaking country, officially left the Francophone African countries, joined the Commonwealth, for goodness sakes. Rwanda is now part of the Commonwealth, one of only two non-British colonies that's now part of the British Commonwealth. And that, of course, when I asked why, they said, well, how can you hurt France the best by rejecting their language and culture, moving out of their bloc and no longer voting the French line? So Rwanda has moved from being French to being anti-French. And what are these French troops doing here? They're not coming to stop the genocide, as Romeo Dallaire, who's a French-speaking Canadian, documents. France came in for no other reason than to actually support the genocidal architects and to protect the Interahamwe and to help them to escape into Zaire, where they could receive sanctuary and escape justice. And so these are French Marines coming to help the Interahamwe and their relatives to escape. And this is how it looked like initially, the refugee camps. Millions of Rwandans fled the Democratic Republic of the Congo, of course, almost all Hutu. And here's the French coming in with their... the way they wear their berets, I've never seen anything like it. We always had to have our badge over our eye. But nope, these characters, forget about being over your right eye. They've got it look to the side of the head. They always look a bit weird. And the way they carry their knives and everything, it's just... Yeah, quite nice. French flags. I don't know what these poor people thought. I mean, these soldiers are just obeying orders, but they must have thought, honestly, protect these people. Should have been driving them to prison. And so this is the Operation Turquoise safe haven, southwestern section, where they led them just south of Lake Kivu into Zaire. And this is the scene. People carrying everything they possibly could, all their worldly goods on their heads and leaving. And of course, one has to feel sorry for these people in some ways, but on the other hand, many of them would have been accessories to the genocide or actual participants or relatives of those. Others might have been people who were not involved but still felt that they could be maybe targeted just because they're Hutu. So obviously there's innocent people locked up in it. But then you get other scenes where you can only think, these people running with their clubs, why are the French Marines, who've even got a cross as part of their symbol, protecting people who are obviously accessories to the genocide? And the UN comes in and all that massive amount of aid. And you can see the kind of, these are the kind of 20-litre drums that we've distributed to people up in Nuba Mountains and so on too. But these are doubtless UN provided. Here's Red Cross pouring in the aid. But as African Rights says, they weren't giving the aid to the victims of the genocide, they're giving the aid to the accessories to the genocide or the actual perpetrators. What a job. So this is the timeline, this is how it worked out, and of course the regional effects were colossal. Because of the genocide, a whole lot of Tutsi refugees in Uganda moved in and became the next government of Rwanda. A whole lot of Hutus fled into the Congo and Tanzania. When acts of terrorism, as Rwanda calls it, were perpetrated against Rwanda, Rwanda and Uganda used this as an excuse to go in to Congo and wipe out a whole lot of the Hutu who were either participants in the genocide or maybe they were just there. And so you had a knock-on effect. And before this was over, 12 countries were involved in a Great Lakes War. We're talking about 1996, 1997, 98. There was this Great Lakes War, which even our good friend John Boyd got sucked up into. He was at the Nyankunde Missionary Aviation Fellowship headquarters, their flagship, one of the oldest of the MAF air bases in the field. And they had just moved there a few weeks before after years of preparation, language study and Bible college and flight training and everything else. And they had 20 minutes warning. Armed force heading towards you, get out. And they managed to take off with less than 20 kilograms personal kit. As they were taking off, they saw their house and hangar and everything go up in flames. These troops, whoever they were, came through and just destroyed everything. And so they lost Nyankunde, their premier Missionary Aviation Fellowship base in the field in a matter of minutes. And something like 10 years preparation wiped out after less than a couple of weeks in the field. That's their first mission field. After that, they were sent to Haiti, which I said was worse than the Congo, and much worse. In this war, the Great Lakes War, the Sudan army got involved, Central African Republic, Congo, Brazzaville got involved, Angolan forces, Namibian army, Zimbabwean army was involved, of course, Tanzanian, Burundi, Rwanda, Ugandan army. 12 different countries' armies were involved in the Great Lakes War, and I don't think anyone's come up with the final figure yet, but millions died. More than? Yes, so this is many millions were killed in the Great Lakes War. Yes, yes, lots of Congolese. But it all started with the knock-on effect of the Rwandan Holocaust and moving into the Congo, Congo giving the Hutu sanctuary. And before you knew it, millions were killed. And I don't know if the effects are over. But, I mean, how many people? I've heard people talking about 6 to 7 million people could have died in the Congo in the Great Lakes War. Have you heard numbers?
I didn't get numbers, but when you studied, you said that it was like the statistic was bigger than any other war after the Second World War.
In Africa, it must have been the most devastating war ever. As somebody said, the Great Lakes War was similar to what the First World War would have been for Europe, for Africa. It involved 12 countries. Yes. And it's colossal. It was like a world war, or at least an African war, version of the European World War One, what it was to Africa. Totally, catastrophically disastrous. And so this is just a knock-on effect. And then part of it, in the whole role of things, Kabila takes control of the Congo, later gets killed by his bodyguard, they say, which is actually impossible. They put the blame on the assassination of the elder Kabila on his bodyguard who died. Well, how convenient is that? The chance that the bodyguard is the one responsible, and there's no conspiracy, you know, and the new government didn't do it. Well, most likely is the new government did the coup, assassinated the president, killed his bodyguard, who's probably died trying to protect the president, and then blamed him. But everybody involved in being a bodyguard and so on that I've spoken to around the world doesn't believe the story. So this is classic case of the new government just blame the bodyguard because it's just next to impossible. Now, the first film to come out in this, Hotel Rwanda, it probably was a bit disturbing for anyone to watch it. It disturbed me more for the fact of how dishonest and inaccurate this film was than the actual facts, because it was so unrealistic. It bothered me. Now, it's based on a true story, and the hotel manager who actually saved 1,200 people by his ingenuity and courage deserves a good film to be made about it. But in it, they're awfully soft on the UN. They actually have the UN trying to do something. In fact, the UN actually fired some shots, okay, into the ground, but still, which is more than it actually did. But in this film, these are Americans playing Rwandese. That's not the way Rwandese. This is South Africa. You can see it, South Africa. You can look at the roads. You can look at everything. This is totally South Africa. And it was all filmed in South Africa. I stayed in Hotel Millis Colonus, and it doesn't look anything like this. And in this film, it's barely a one-story hotel. Actually, the hotel is a multi-story hotel. This is about the only religious anything you can see. You see a couple of nuns wandering around there. But interestingly, just to make things simple, all the UN troops are white Europeans. Not that they were in actual facts there, but it helps give the impression that in the film, yeah, here we go, that's the only religious symbol in the whole film. You don't see them praying or anything any other time, but they try to ignore the real blame, and they have in it a very, very unacceptable scene that to me is the most obnoxious part of this film. In Hotel Rwanda, there's a scene where the chap playing a Canadian colonel in the UN says, you know, they don't care about you because you're black. And that's just so dishonest, because who's the head of the Security Council, some Kofi Annan from Ghana. He's the one who's giving the orders here. Who's the local superior? Bubu, who's the Cameroonian foreign minister. So it's all Africans making. In fact, it's even an Egyptian who's the general secretary of the UN at the time. He's making out that this is a bunch of racist things because the UN's white and you're black, they don't care about you. But that's not true. What he should have said is, you're Christians. Well, that would have been true. Because the UN had no problem rushing in to help Somalian Muslims, but they wouldn't help Rwandan Christians. That's the issue. And so Hotel Rwanda is very dishonest, but what do you expect from low-life scum at the United Nations and Hollywood? This scene gives a bit more action than the UN actually did. actually drew the weapons. Wow. But still, it's got an important message, but they don't tell you who was doing it, to whom it was being done, why it was being done. They left out the Christian angles. So I think Hotel Rwanda is a film to boycott personally. Far more honest and accurate would be looking at the films like Shake Hands with the Devil. So this is the headquarters that the Pakistanis abandoned to the Interahamwe on the orders of Kofi Annan. The grave is only half full. Who will help us fill it? The RTLM radio station or Radio de Milanes Colonies literally was broadcasting not just hate speech, vulgar, crude, racist, genocidal hate speech. It was guiding the people literally block by block where to go and so on. And the Canadian general requested the Americans to use their radio jamming equipment to block the transmission, that it would save lives. And what did the Americans say? They don't think they could do that because it could be a violation of international law. A violation of international law? Since when did the American government ever care about that? They violate international law all the time. But suddenly they developed some ethics about international law to prevent them saving lives by blocking transmission of radio because they think that this could interfere with free speech. You've got to be kidding. This, I remember this Time magazine cover coming out. There are no devils left in hell, the missionary said. They're all in Rwanda. Not a very intelligent comment, but still, it's one of the comments that was made at the time and published. This is the General Romeo Dallaire, head of the UN UNIMIR operation in Rwanda. He really tried, it would seem. He actually believed the propaganda. He actually believed the UN was there for the good of the people. And he is devastated. He was absolutely destroyed by this. He became suicidal. He is found as a drunk lying on a bench in a park in Toronto. Notice this subtitle. Shake Hands with the Devil. What's the subtitle? The Failure of Humanity in Rwanda. I mean, again, you just see, he couldn't even put the failure of the UN. It's a failure of humanity. I think he was so indoctrinated in Canada with the UN is the world and the UN is humanity. And he was staggered because he really thought he was there to help. And you can get it through the book. This poor man actually believed that his superiors had good intentions. Well, you certainly learn otherwise when you read the book and get to the film. And the film's been well produced. In fact, this is probably the best film to have come out of Canada ever. And filmed in Rwanda. Well worth seeing. I showed it to the students at Back to the Bible, and they were very shaken. Very, very constructive, good discussions that came out of it. The British made this film, Shooting Dogs. Now, the title is quite obnoxious. So in America, it was released in the name of Beyond the Gates. The title is because the Catholic missionary at one point explodes in fury when he asks why the soldiers have guns if they won't use them to protect the people and stop people from being murdered. And he says, we're only allowed to use the guns to shoot the dogs that feed off the corpses. So you're not allowed to shoot the people making the corpses, but you are here to shoot the dogs who are eating the results of man's inhumanity to man. And this just represents the futility and the insanity and the hypocrisy and cowardice of UN policy, which is made by Kofi Annan in Rwanda, and that they made as the title of the film, Shooting Dogs. Absolutely beyond disgusting, but Beyond the Gates, as the Americans released it, I'm sure a lot of animal rights activists were horrified at the title, so they had to come up with a nicer title. But this is an honest film, and it portrays that at the end, when they decide to pull out everyone, all the foreigners and the UN troops, and the British missionary decides, I'm going to stay and die with my people. And this actually happened at the ETO. I went to the school, ETO school, where it happened, where they filmed it. 2,500 Tutsi Protestants in the school under UN protection, and the UN drives out, and outside the gates, beyond the gates, you get the Inter Humbri toy-toying there and with their whistles. And as the last UN vehicle pulls out, blow the whistle and all rush in. The disgustingness. And the way the UN did it was they told the people to gather in the hall where they were going to have a meal. And so didn't even tell them what they were doing. They just abandoned them without warning them. The cowardice of it. But the missionary understood, and he stayed with his people, singing with them and praying with them, because he said, I can't leave my flock. He realized, this is where it happened, ETO, basically the technical school. And William Hurt, I think the last film he played in, if I'm not mistaken, I saw these sort of things in the museum, that kind of club. Looks like something from the Middle Ages. And so the film is told from the eyes of a BBC journalist who was there and an eyewitness. And so this is, it's got the smell and hint of realism. And yes, I've been right to the school in and around it. And we've got this film in our library. I'd recommend it with caution because it's a harsh portrayal. But this is reality. And how can you possibly communicate what's gone on? But at least in Rwanda, the victims have become the victors. David beat Goliath. And so the truth has been able to come out. And so they've got a genocide museum in Kigali. And by the way, this is what it looks like today when you go to Natarama Church, which I went into. They've taken out the bodies. They've cleaned up the bodies and the bones and everything. But they've left the clothes. They actually cleaned the clothes first and then left them there so it wouldn't have insects, rats. Cleaned up the whole thing, but they've left the clothes behind as a memorial. And so this is what it looks like today. And outside, they've got the bones having been cleaned, and just as a silent testimony, notice the clubs, the evidence of clubs being used on skulls. People walking around with baseball bats, you know, that sort of thing. That's what you're talking about. And racks and racks and racks of skulls. And so sometimes people have put up some of the purple and white flags, commemoration days, like on the 6th of April they would have done this. This isn't a genocide museum. Heaps of the clothes, they've cleaned the clothes, but they're back there. They've separated out the bones, separated out the skulls. And it's in the genocide museum. They've tried to get pictures, because this is the thing. The whole point about a genocide is to wipe out a people. And as with the Soviets, with the Bolshevik, Cambodian, Red Chinese genocides, Ethiopia and so on, it's so important to put faces to the victims that people do not forget them. And, of course, to show some of the weapons used. This is a low-tech weapon, a low-tech genocide. More people were killed with machetes in Rwanda in 6 weeks than have died from nuclear weapons in all of history. How many books have been written on nuclear weapons and the threat of nuclear holocaust? But, I mean, pangas have still killed more people than any nuclear weapons. And these would be the relatives, the children, the survivors, the children of the next generation. This is at the 20th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide. And you just wonder how traumatized everyone in the country must be from this. So when they talk about mass shootings, well, the governments are the mass undisputed heavyweight champions of mass shootings. Nobody has killed more people in governments. And so isn't it interesting that whether it is the mosque getting shot up in New Zealand, which is probably a false flag organized by the very government concerned, because they instantly go straight into operation taking away people's weapons. So, okay, you can imagine that some sheep are attacked by a wolf. And in attack, people noticed the wolf had teeth and used teeth. So the solution, pull the teeth out of all the sheep. The sheep have all their teeth removed, and this is going to protect them from future attacks by wolves. Make sense? Well, that's why the role of gun control is right at the top. There are still people wanted for the genocide, some who have been captured and are taken through justice systems, but others are living either protected in the Congo or in Canada or in France. Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda, who's head of the Rwandese Patriotic Front that won the war and ended the genocide, he said, we don't want foreign aid. I mean, to hell with foreign aid. We don't want any of your foreign aid. We just want fair trade. And Rwanda today is selling billions of tulips to Amsterdam. They fly tulips, their coffee, their tulips, things like this. They are, because Amsterdam, Holland can't produce enough tulips for the world market. So they literally have subcontracted to Rwanda. Rwanda's doing a lot of very brilliant trade. In fact, it's documented that they have the least amount of paperwork to start a business. You don't need more than one piece of paper form to open up a business in Rwanda. It's, they're just pro-free enterprise.
But if you let them there as well, they arrest you.
Oh, I think if you have a plastic bag, they'll want to lock you up.
Yeah. Bags,
you're not allowed to have plastic bags, that's correct. It's a serious... the country definitely, they clamp down heavily on all sorts of things. But yes, you don't have litter. As head of the United Nations peacekeeping operations in the mid-1990s, before he became Secretary General, Kofi Annan never apologized to the victims of the Rwandan genocide, whose slaughter was the consequence of the UN's failure to intervene, hasn't even apologized to the families of those massacred in Serbia while under protection of UN soldiers. Annan's lack of humility, to put it mildly, his arrogance, in the face of such great human tragedy, has been one of the greatest shortcomings. Concerning the massacre of over 800,000 Rwandans, which according to the Genocide Museum, they've got the names of 1,170,000. So all Kofi Annan could say on the 10th anniversary of the genocide was, the world failed you. Now how's that? I didn't fail you. The UN didn't fail you. Not the Security Council. The world failed you. This is typical secular humanist inability to take blame or to take responsibility. It's not my fault. It's the world's fault. Their fault. All of them. Every last one of them. Well, actually, maybe it is, because there's been over 150 wars since the UN was founded in 1945. And the further society drifts from the truth, the more they'll hate the people who speak the truth, said George Orwell in his 1984. Truth is hate for those who hate the truth. Basically, I think the UN are a bunch of gangsters with flags. The UN's Human Rights Council is an unmitigated farce. They've jettisoned all sensibility and freedom. Their lack of membership criteria means they're open to manipulation by the world's worst human rights abusers. The Human Rights Council in the UN consists of the governments of Burma, Syria, Libya, and Sudan, some of the worst governments on the planet, and Zimbabwe on the Human Rights Council. And so even North Korea. So when the council elections are held, leading human rights abusers like Algeria, China, Cuba, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia were all elected. This is beyond a farce. And then who do they invite to speak to the podiums? Fidel Castro, Che Guevara, Yasser Arafat, dictators, mass murderers like, yes, dear old Mugabe. And here's Kofi Annan giving credence and respectability to one of the worst, longest-serving dictators on the planet. So the UN's the largest collection of unelected mass murderers and human traffickers, drug dealers. They're just a bunch of gangsters with flags. And their hostility to Christianity is obvious because they never address the targeting of Christian minorities, and they always support the dictators who persecute Christians. So the disgraceful track record of the United Nations, whenever they've militarily intervened in nations, reveals their true nature. The UN is Antichrist, giving evil a voice since 1945. Well depicted. UN humanitarian aid gives a trickle to the victims and a lot to the dictators. Unaccountable because terrorist lackeys need retirement plans too. Kofi Annan, one of the most corrupt criminals on the planet. You'll never find a more wretched hive of scum and villainy. Anyone identify that quote?
Star Wars.
Exactly, Star Wars. That's where it comes from. But it's far more appropriate to the UN, though. And the United Nations has been the forefront of advocating homosexuality, bestowing of rights reserved for the family on homosexual unions, and Kofi Annan supported abortion as essential. Hence, bizarre that ACDP's premier pro-life advocate could have lavished so much praise on Kofi Annan at his death. Kofi Annan has emphasized sexual and reproductive health as an essential part of human rights. What does that mean? What he's saying is you can kill your babies. That's what he means. He supports abortion and other population control methods, including sex education, should be declared human right. By the way, that is Planned Parenthood's HQ. Doesn't it sort of look pretty Babylonian, Aztec, kind of human sacrifice type thing? Well, it is.
The cloud looks like a skull.
Yeah, I think that was deliberately designed that way. That's a bit of Photoshop. So this is where safe abortions, according to the UN, on white, less safe as yellow, and least safe as dark. So they're reckoning most of Africa's unsafe abortions. But of course, the quantity, most abortions take place in Asia. And so I don't think any abortion is safe for the baby, but they're not talking about that. The ultimate assault on human rights. So although this new category of human rights has been the emphasis, it's what Kofi Annan says is the need to stabilize the population of plant. What he means is bring the population of plant below 1 billion. And he's one of the depopulations to see legitimization protection of homosexuality as one of the ways to keep procreation down, undermine marriage and other institutions and other special religions that emphasize children as a blessing. And so they are the biggest pusher of abortion on the planet. When you look at the UN and what they've done and what they allow and what they promote and what they're responsible for, and their treachery, how they could stand by and not save lives. It is appointed unto man once to die, and after that comes the judgment. We must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive the things done in the body, whether good or bad. We will be judged according to God's law. Then I saw a great white throne, and him who sat upon it, whose face the earth and the heavens fled away, and there was found no place for them. And I saw the dead, small and great, standing before God, and books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged according to their works, by the things that were written in the books. And the sea gave up the dead who were in it, and death and Hades delivered up the dead who were in them, and they were judged, each one according to his works. Then death and Hades was cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. And anyone not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. I've been asked on a number of occasions through my life and ministry, how can a good and loving God allow hell? And my answer is, how can a good and loving God not have an eternal hell for those who seem to escape justice on earth? God would not be good or holy or loving if he did not have a day of judgment and a day of reckoning and an eternal hell for those who reject his grace and who violate his laws. And so I think it's one of the comforts that we can give the victims is what our Lord taught, John 5. Do not marvel at this, for the hour is coming in which all who are in their graves will hear his voice and come forth, and those who have done good to the resurrection of life, and those who have done evil to the resurrection of condemnation. Yeah, we never pledge allegiance to this flag, and it'll be cold day in hell before we do. There'll be ice skating in hell before we pledge allegiance to this cursed flag. When I've had UN Flag Day, sometimes I've observed it by putting a UN flag as a doormat. And that's the only, and you've noticed we've got this nice poster, UN Free Zone. So, as far as the UN goes, we don't like them. So, any comments, any questions? Yes. Yes. Well, I have not investigated the Great Lakes War. It was such chaotic shambles and a mess there. It's hard to fully tell who did what. There were 12 countries' armies there. Are we sure that all those atrocities were done by the Rwandese, considering the Ugandans, the Sudanese, and everyone else was involved too? What was done by who? Do you know anyone who's done a research? Is there any book or study or documentary out on the Great Lakes War? it's worth doing, because yes, what fully happened in that is a study well worth doing.
And the thing is, it's called a war. It's not called a genocide in Congo. It's just a genocide.
Not quite as cold-blooded as this one. This was very cold-blooded. But yes, if you're killing civilians or killing unarmed people, that's mass murder. That's never acceptable, whoever does it. But I have not investigated that. I haven't been there. I can't tell what happened in northern Congo. But the Great Lakes War was horrific. And what we've heard from MAF, as John Boyd has said, flew out there and I could just see these. They think they were Kabila's people who would then won the rebels. Now, the Kabila crowd they were Maoists. They took control over the Congo as a direct result of the Great Lakes War and the falling of Mobutu Sese Seko. But Mobutu Sese Seko was one of the people who actually supported the Hutus and welcomed them in after everything that's happened in Rwanda. So you can see the ripple effect's disastrous. And this is the thing, you can't have a crime in one area and not affect the neighbors. So yes, I don't know the full story at the end of it, but plainly there was a revenge. Now, to what extent Uganda and Rwanda went into the Congo on hot pursuit, preemptive raid, or to what extent it was revenge, I don't know. I haven't heard anyone who's done any decent kind of investigation, so I'm not sure. It's highly suspicious. But it could also be they're threatening our security and we need to preemptively raid, but if they're attacking civilians and killing civilians, well, now that's unjustifiable mass murder. But again, I would be speaking out of complete ignorance. I don't know what happened up there. If you can find any good source in that, then we must look into it and make that known. But yes, there's only all I can speak about is what happened in Rwanda.
It still seems unclear to me why exactly the Hutus hated the Tutsis so much.
That's a good question.
To the point that they were willing to slaughter them.
Okay. Historically, I give some of this in the book Holocaust in Rwanda. The Hutus were the tillers of the ground, farmers. The Tutsi were pastoralists. They came with the cattle herds and the goat herds and sheep and so on. So the Tutsi also are believed to have come primarily from Ethiopia. So they were later, as in 500 years ago, immigrants into the area. The Hutus were there first, they could say. So they described them as hermetic invaders, cockroaches, Indienzis, another word for cockroaches. And now the Tutsi, because they were Protestants, tended to have a higher literacy rate. They tend to be wealthier. They were more educated. They were higher literacy rate. There's all those sort of things. So, of course, the Marxists came and they stirred the pot to get resentment on a tribal basis that the Tutsi are to blame for you being poor, not the socialist government who's been running the country since 1962 and their stupid policies. But the Tutsi are personally responsible. So you can see it's useful for any commie government that's failed to fulfill their promises to have a scapegoat. We see how that worked in Zimbabwe, how it works here. So the Tutsi were convenient to blame because they had a high standard of living, they had higher literacy, they had a higher education level. Therefore, they were wealthier and they tend to have better positions and better farms and so on and so forth. So you had greed, envy, socialism, Marxism, all of this working together in a toxic mix being stirred up by the government, who obviously wanted to keep them out. Now, when the Germans arrived, the Tutsi were the kings. They ruled the place. And when the Belgians were there, they were also. So basically, there was indirect rule, which is pretty standard. The British did it, the Belgians did it, the French did it, which is that you don't interfere, you let the chiefs rule and so on. You don't actually try to rule the whole country. You have indirect rule. As long as the chiefs pay basic homage or taxes or whatever to the central government, they let them run it. So when the Belgians left 1962, the Hutu majority, intoxicated by this new experience of one man, one vote, oh, there's more of us than all of the Tutsi, but the Tutsi had always ruled. They were the kings, they were the everything. Well, overthrew the monarchy, they established a democracy, they killed the royal family and everything else like that. And then they took over. And so right then what you had was a basic revolution and socialism. And now there was this, well, they've got better farms, better houses, or there might have been resentment, used to be the head of the police, whatever. So there was a few thousand Tutsi murdered here, a few thousand there. So over the years, there was this endless attacks on the Tutsi because they were perceived as, you're the old guard, you're the old rulers. It wasn't so much that they were ruled by the Germans or the Belgians, they were ruled by the Tutsi. And so there was a resentment that was, it's again just typical, that the failures of today have to blame someone, so they blame the previous guys. And because they're a minority, they couldn't say much, and now the government controlled the media. So reading the kind of garbage that was spewed out against them, you know, that's the sort of thing. They're exploiters, oppressors of the proletariat, and on and on and on. So that's the excuse. The reason why you're suffering is it's their fault.
Sounds familiar.
Doesn't it? Yeah, it's almost like it's happened since.
Where does the UN get their money from, and can a real Christian work for the UN? Because one of the reasons the UN withdraw is they said they do not have enough bullets to fight in Rwanda, and they must redraw because it's costing too much money, actually.
Yes, right. Well, of course, they never had enough bullets, but who was responsible for that? Boo Boo and Kofi Annan. They specifically made sure they were always being promised more, but they weren't given what this. As General Romeo Dallaire said, we didn't even have enough money, we didn't have enough bullets to go to the target practice at the shooting range. We couldn't have sustained ourselves in an ongoing war because we would have run out so quickly. We had one magazine and that was it for our pistols, and we had no extra magazines for our rifles. Basically, it was for show. You couldn't sustain an operation because the ammo was still meant to be coming. The armored cars were still meant to be coming. They never came. But even when they had 15,000 refugees in one base, they weren't given more food, weren't given medicines. They said mothers were dying in childbirth for lack of medicines in UN bases. People were dying of starvation in UN bases because there wasn't enough food. People were dying of waterborne disease because they didn't get the water purification tablets and things like this. So the UN set General Romeo Dallaire up to fail. And then they could blame him. And do you know what happened to the Belgian officer in charge of his section? He was court-martialed when he went back to Belgium for losing those 10 troops. But they were operating under the orders of the UN, which was, you're not allowed to fire unless fired upon, which is insane. In the middle of absolute genocidal chaos, and you're not allowed to fire until fired upon, they're surrounded, outnumbered, and as far as they understood from the orders, because they were weren't being fired upon, if they ordered to hand over the weapons, they had to do that. Well, the officer who was court-martialed wasn't the one to blame. It's the people who gave those stupid orders. The rules of engagement designed by Kofi Annan were absolutely set up for failure. Yeah, so this is super important at this particular moment in time because we've got people who would like to do this here. In fact, we've had people like Malema and co. speaking on those very terms. I was down the road in Kelvin Grove many years ago now. Kelvin Grove, maybe it's 15 years ago. I believe it was 1999, 20 years ago. And there was different political parties speaking. And the ANC chap stood up and he said, when Nelson Mandela dies, we're going to kill you whites like flies. So I said then, I said, you mean like Rwanda? He said, yes, exactly like Rwanda. I said, did you notice what happened there? There's a sound. Said, did you notice how it turned out? He said, you know, that the victims are now the victors. You know, that the people who are being genocided now the governments of Rwanda. And nobody questions that the minority Tutsi have the right to rule anymore because the Hutu majority destroyed their credibility worldwide by engaging in such horrific acts of genocide. So there's no more sympathy for them. And I said, the Tutsi didn't have a history of military experience and brilliance in the field, but have you noticed how much the Boers have? I said, do you know how many wars the SADF fought and won? Do you know how many hundreds of thousands of veterans there are who fought a real war? How many weapons are on South Africa? I said, do you know how quickly things could boomerang on anyone who tried a genocide here? said, you might kill some people in the beginning, but when the boomerang turned around, and when all the South Africans overseas, especially those tens of thousands fighting for the Americans and the British and Middle East, came home with their friends, how different things would be. Have you considered that? And he was speechless. He had nothing more to say the whole meeting, Calvin Grove. But in 2010, there was another talk that when the World Cup soccer's over, then we're going to genocide all the whites. So I've been hearing this stuff, you know, as long as I've been alive. I remember from the time I was five hearing about, you know, this impi's going to come over the horizon and wipe you all out any moment. And I've been hearing this over and over and over. But part of it is, of course, intimidation. So that, and of course, more than half of the whites in South Africa have fled the country. They're living in Australia, Canada, America, Britain, wherever. Even Paraguay, goodness me, they're going. So they brought the numbers down, but not enough. But of course, a lot of this talk and riots and things, it's designed to get more to flee and more to flee, so that they've got less to fight at the end. It's part of a tactic. But actually, bullies are cowards. And you see this also in Rwanda, that these people in this big mob, they were fine, brave when they were dealing with unarmed people. But the moment they faced a few pathetically ill-armed Rwandese patriotic front, who were outnumbered by the Hutus, no, who knows how much, 10 to 1 even, they fled. I mean, it's just classic. Bullies are cowards, and you see it everywhere in life, everywhere. Bullies can only work in a big mob. And you go for the one on top, the leader, the ringleader, the rest just flee. They are spineless. So South Africans should not be intimidated by what happened in Rwanda. We should rather be inspired. First of all, warned not to ever allow this. But secondly, the fact that these people can't carry it out. They can scare you into fleeing and giving up and not fighting. But if people do choose to fight back, well, it's tickets for them. That's over. But what's also important is if anyone is expecting salvation from the UN... that's a false hope. So it's important for us to know, and I'm glad there's groups like Straight Londoners and others, but again, obviously the government would plan to infiltrate and subvert them in this. Simon Roach is a classic example of such an agent provocateur. You get this almost anywhere. People from the other side who are there to rile up, and they're also extremists, and they want to explode everything, and they often want to urge ridiculous, unwise, aggressive actions which will just play into enemies' hands. And that's why I'm convinced that the attack on a Muslim mosque in mosques in New Zealand is a total false flag. I think it's completely orchestrated. I think that the New Zealand government's completely complicit in it, or at least in the cover-up of it, because it's got all the hallmarks of a false flag. And when you look at our newsletter and video that we've done on false flags and deception operations, it's got all the hallmarks, all of these false flag operations through history. Big, they look so big, you think there's no way that could be a false flag. I mean, what government would murder their own people? But it's not just a matter of theory now, it's a matter of history. There's a whole range of them that governments do. If they want extra power, they often organize some terrible atrocity, conveniently blame it on somebody, and then this justifies the suppressing of freedoms, rounding up of weapons, and accumulating more power for the powers that be. Good. Any other comments, questions?
In the film Shaking Hands with the Devil, the general is seen talking with the Interahamwe guys. Who or what were they precisely?
They were the leaders of three particular sub-tribal groups amongst the Hindus who were the leaders of the Interahamwe, and of course they had the full support of the government, the MRND government, and
the
military.
They
were not military, they were not official government people, they were the tribal rabble-rousers. I mean, they were sort of like the Julius Malema and the BLF leader and that sort of character. And as he said, you know, as he's going in to meet, he takes his magazine out, his 9mm, and leaves it with his aide-de-camp in the car and says, I don't want to do something I'm going to regret. But then later he regrets that he didn't kill these three creeps, and could have saved a lot of lives when he went to meet them. In fact, I'm sure that this is the thing. You live to regret when you've been a coward or obeyed orders sometimes. You probably wouldn't regret doing the right thing. But he was so pre-programmed to obey orders and follow the rules of engagement given to him from above. Of course, he had the rest of his life to regret that. Yeah. I mean, it's a disgusting thing, what these guys did, but the hatred. And by the way, I was at Kwasi Sibantu Mission some years later in Chel Olsen's home having breakfast there with a person from Rwanda. And it came very quickly out as we were talking over the breakfast table. This guy was completely in support of what the entire movement did. He's, no, but the Tutsis deserved it. And he came out to this and the other. And I was sitting there saying, are you defending the Intahambwe? And he's like, yes, because the Tutsi, they were Inyenzis. He literally used the Inyenzis, cockroaches. They didn't deserve to live. They owned all the businesses. They had all the wealth. They owned the farms and so on and so forth. So here's somebody. And Chell, I remember him widening his eyes, looking over and thinking, I had no idea this guest in my home was on the other side. But literally got him defending this. I don't think he realized someone would be sitting at a table that understood the internal politics. But literally support. One of our GCCs, several years back, I gave a project to our people. One of our outreachers, we're all going to go to traffic lights and speak to the people begging at the traffic lights, selling at traffic lights. And I went to Pineland's Howick Center and the car guards and all that. And do you know how many Rwandese we found? And all of them, when we tracked it down, they would have been 13 or 14 years old or 15 years old during the genocide, which is the main people doing the genocide. 12, 13, 14 year olds. 15 year olds at the outside. Because at that age, they've got no mercy. There's no sense. You can brainwash a 13, 14, 15 year old to do anything. He's got no mercy, no compassion, doesn't know. You know, you tell him the people of that tribe or skin color, they're not human. They don't deserve to live. The guys will generally believe it. And so it's these child soldiers. And so I'd start talking to them. So when are you going back to Rwanda? I can never go back to Rwanda. Why not? No, well, you know, it's complicated. So, but I worked out that all of our car guards at Pylon's Howard Center, they were all Hutu, Rwandese, Intahambwe. So our cars are being guarded by a bunch of genocidal survivors. Now, whether they actually killed people or whether we're just part of the mob, I don't know. But literally, this is a long way to run.
It's just, I mean, even at Kwasi Sibantu, they are huge. Like the main branch was huge. I remember telling myself sitting at the table one day, and there was an elder with his name tag, elder this and this, and we complained because we noticed they were from what do you call, not Watchtower.
A Travis Witness?
No, Mormons. Mormons.
Oh, yes.
Went and complained because we noticed that they, and they were doing evangelism at this, you know, recruiting Kwasi Sibantu people.
Oh, that's clever.
Food,
we don't normally think of warning people about Mormons in our own churches. Gee. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Sorry, I'm getting interrupted all the time. There was something, I think there was an Australian contingent at some stage.
Yes.
There, and they had a war artist with them, and he actually painted some pictures, and one of them shows a guy preaching to people who are about to be killed. Standing there with a Bible and sort of praying and preaching. And in fact, it made it onto the cover of a commentary on Revelation.
Now, he wasn't part of the attackers, was he?
No, he was part of the Australian. Oh, the guy preaching was
yes.
One of the ones in the compound or something. I'll try and find this guy's website.
Well, when I went to Rwanda, I actually got to take hundreds of French and Kinyarwanda Bibles, and of which more than 100 was just inside the prison to Intahambwe people who were going through the trial process. In other words, many of them would probably get executed somewhere along the line. And
they have the death penalty in Rwanda.
Oh, yes. Which is why they don't want to hand anyone over to The Hague to be tried there, because there's no death penalty in Europe for the people who do the... Yes, like, naughty, we're going to put you in a 5-star hotel where you have access to swimming pool, gym... full medical care and
you can even get a degree.
Yes, and library and all that sort of thing, and you've got TV in your cell and all that sort of thing. So, you know, getting locked up in Europe is not that bad, actually, when you think that, gee, you could catch up on a lot of your study and reading. it's you've got limit. They limit your freedom of movement, but it's not exactly like a prison in Africa.
Yeah.
So Rwanda has the death penalty. Obviously, they must. But yes, I was speaking to these people, and it's just like blank. These guys were almost certainly all guilty of mass murder or being part of it. They're all going to get executed. And took them Bibles, shared through interpreter, but I didn't notice any light, it was just like hollow, no receptivity at all in the eyes. Yeah, expropriation without compensation won't be a problem, don't worry.
Yeah. And he's also appealing to white youth not to leave South Africa.
Actually, what he says is irrelevant. It's what he does. Now, what has he done to deal with the rioters, murderers, and so on? If he did something action-wise, like reopening the commandos for defending the farmers. I mean, that would say something. But just talk means nothing.
Oh, you have Cape Town two new trains.
You know, in the last year, we've had 750 trains burned out in Cape Town. Half of all the trains in the Cape Peninsula have been burned in the last year. So if you wonder why train tickets have gone up, yes, anyway, so I think at this time it's important to get a message like this out. Of course, we've got the articles on our website. One is Lessons from the Rwandan Holocaust, which is basically taken from the book Shake Hands with Devil by Romeo Delia, and then his summary, Holocaust in Rwanda 25 Years Later, which is a summary of my book. And if anyone can get the chance to see the film Shake Hands with Devil or Beyond the Gates, those would be worthwhile warnings. And then from the Ukrainian side, to see expropriation without compensation, how that works out, and the genocide up in Ukraine, Bitter Harvest. I mean, and that one's good because that's a spirit of resistance. It's not just what the communists did, but it's got a very strong and a message of hope and resistance, which is so good. And that one was made by Ukrainians in exile in Canada. So there's two good Canadian films, Bitter Harvest and Shake Hands with the Devil. So Canada's not a write-off. They might have one of the worst governments on the planet, but they've made two good films, at least that I know of.
I think we've got that one in the library.
Yes, Bitter Harvest.
And Shake Hands with the
Devil. We do, indeed. Yes, at any rate, it might not be a bad idea to ship that up to Danuba amongst your big external hard drive. Good. It does no harm, because how many films are made in Africa anyway? There's so few that are even vaguely accurate. So, I saw Hotel Rwanda once, and I thought, you know, it's not even worth seeing a second time. It's not worth showing. I'm so disgusted with the blatant distortion and dishonesty in it. And when they make a film and they completely leave out the reality of the Christians, and there's not a prayer, there's not a hymn, there's nothing Christian in the whole of Hotel Rwanda. You think, this is just so reprehensible. I just loathe these creeps in Hollywood. They can make a film on the Wild West where there's no church, there's no prayer, there's no preacher, there's no faith, no Bible. There was revival going on throughout the whole of the Wild West during the time that they've made these cowboy films. But since the 1970s, they uniformly portray them as a bunch of secular humanist atheists. It's just not right. My mother, as a nurse, said she never saw anyone going into surgery without prayer. Said, what you have in these medical films where the people go into surgery without a prayer, said, in her experience, a lifetime in medicine, never saw it happen. Now, if it happens, it's rare that people go into surgery without a prayer. I mean, even the atheists are calling for the chaplain. And that's true in the army too. I mean, there's no atheist in the foxhole. Apparently, there's no atheist going in for major surgery either. And I doubt that there were many atheists in the middle of the, you know, when there's genocide going on, even the atheists calling for God's help. So.
Yeah.